listening to the CCA Podcast.
I was 16 years old, and I was really excited to be a foreign exchange student in Germany. And so I was going there to live with a family. The family that I was living with was a Lutheran family, and my parents were very, you know, they were very particular about that. They wanted to make sure that I was living with a Christian family. Well, like many Germans, they were Lutheran in name only. There was really not any practice of the faith. They didn't attend church at all, except on the day of my German brother's confirmation was the only time that they attended church while I was there. Later on, my mom found out that my German teacher was really hoping that she could kind of dig that religion out of me. You know, she thought I was just too protected, too religious. And so she was really hoping that Germany would open up my eyes to broader horizons. And so I've told you this before. The second day I was there, I was invited to a party. And we went down into a basement, and there were a bunch of teenagers sitting around on the floor, and there were candles glowing. This is the 70s, right? It was 1970, actually. And there were candles, and then all of a sudden, the hash pipe starts coming around the circle. And I'm like, oh, Jesus, I'm not in Kansas anymore, you know? And I was in a place where now I was very much separated from the loving family, the Christian family that I knew, the church, Calvary Temple back then, this body. I was separated definitely from my own parents. And I was put in a place where my faith was on trial, and there were really two questions that were being asked in my own heart. One was, is Jesus really who he says he is? Does this faith stuff make sense? Is it intellectually credible? Does it stand up? I was now separated from these bulwarks that had stood around me, and I was there standing on my own. It was like, okay, is there ground for me to stand on that's going to make intellectual credible sense? The second trial was this: can I really obey this stuff? Can I stand firm in the commitments that I've made now that I'm separated from all those who would stand around me and who would feel the same way I do? And so it's, do I really believe this stuff, and can I really live this stuff? Those were the two trials. In some ways, I think that that's where all of us find ourselves, at least at certain points in time. Do I really believe this stuff, and can I really live this stuff? And I think that that's what's happening in this particular passage that we're looking at today in Mark chapter 14. And so we're going to start right at the point where Jesus was arrested in the Garden of Gethsemane. It's in Mark 14 and starting at verse 43. And it goes like this: just as he was speaking, that is Jesus, he was speaking, he was telling his disciples, hey, look, the betrayer is here. Just as he was speaking, Judas, one of the 12, appeared. And with him was a crowd armed with swords and clubs, sent from the chief priests, the teachers of the law, and the elders. Now the betrayer had arranged a signal with them: the one I kiss is the man. Arrest him and lead him away under guard. Going at once to Jesus, Judas said, "Rabbi," and kissed him. The men seized Jesus and arrested him. Then one of those standing near drew his sword and struck the servant of the high priest, cutting off his ear. Just a note here. It's so fascinating, isn't it, that Judas came and with actually two demonstrations of respect. So he comes to Jesus and he calls him Rabbi, which is it's a word of affirmation of Jesus' authority as a teacher. He's demonstrating respect to him and calling him Rabbi. And then he kisses him. The kiss is the normal greeting, and it's a sign of affection. It's a sign of respect. And so Judas uses two demonstrations of respect to perform the ultimate denial, betrayal. And you see the guards, the temple guards who had come with them, they wouldn't necessarily have recognized Jesus, and particularly not in the dark. So they want to make it clear who the man is who's to be arrested. And so he betrays him with a kiss. It's also interesting that the man, you know, I talked about this last week, the high priest's servant, his ear being chopped off. I don't think I mentioned last week that in John's gospel tells us that his name was Malchus, and that it was Peter who had chopped off his ear. Now, why would John tell us that his name was Malchus? Well, the most likely reason is that Malchus became known in the community of faith, that he became a believer. And so when John talks about him and says, "Oh, this happened, Malchus, you know him," he actually was there. Peter went for his head, he ducked, his ear chopped off, and then Jesus healed him again. So this really interesting little vignette, little story of the servant of the high priest and his ear getting cut off, and very likely the result being that eventually he himself came to faith. Well, the passage goes on and says, Jesus says, "Am I leading a rebellion that you have come out with swords and clubs to capture me? Every day I was with you teaching in the temple courts, and you did not arrest me, but the scriptures must be fulfilled." Then everyone deserted him and fled. So the disciples, in spite of all their protestation that they were going to, "Boy, no one, you know, everybody else may deny you, Jesus, but I'm not going to deny you. I'm going to be there. I'm going to stick by your side." Boom. The going gets tough, and the tough get going. In other words, out of there. In fact, a young man wearing nothing but a linen garment was following Jesus, and when they seized him, and he fled naked, leaving his garment behind. No one else tells that story except Mark. And very early in the Christian tradition, there are accounts that the reason nobody else tells the story except Mark is that it was Mark was the one. That Mark, in fact, was a young man. What we know is that Mark's parents lived in Jerusalem, and that very likely, tradition tells us, that it was in Mark's household that was the upper room, that was where the disciples celebrated the Last Supper, the Passover with Christ. And so Mark then ended up following them into the garden, kind of the tag-along, the young man. He's wearing a linen garment. The normal garment that you would wear would have been a garment of wool. Some have indicated that the fact that it's a linen garment probably shows some degree of affluence, because a linen garment is much more comfortable than a rough-hewn wool garment. But probably more important is simply this. this is a fine detail that an eyewitness would think of. Oh, yeah, it was a linen garment. And I'd put it on hurriedly to follow them and didn't have time to put on my underwear. And so then he's like, oh, I got to get out of here. And one of the guards grabs his linen garment and whoosh, he's gone naked. I mean, when I was a kid, I'd think about that. I'd just, whoa, what a cool story, you know. Mark thought it was cool enough that he put it in his gospel. They took Jesus to the high priest, and all the chief priests and the elders and the teachers of the law came together. Peter followed him at a distance right into the courtyard of the high priest. There he sat with the guards and warmed himself at the fire. The chief priests and the whole Sanhedrin were looking for evidence against Jesus so that they could put him to death. Now that goes to show, Mark's that's an editorial comment on Mark's part. This was not a sincere trial. This was not a trial that was unbiased. They already were looking for evidence to put Jesus to death. They'd already decided the direction that it was going to go or that they wanted it to go. So they were looking for evidence, but they didn't find any. Many testified falsely against him, but their statements did not agree. Then some stood up and gave this false testimony against him. We heard him say, I will destroy this temple made with human hands, and in 3 days will build another not made with hands. Yet even then their testimony did not agree. Now, Jesus is coming before the Sanhedrin. It's 70 elders in the Jewish system. They are the highest authorities in the land, the highest religious authorities. They have to kowtow to the secular authorities, the Romans. So they're not able to do everything that they want to do, but they have the capacity to cast judgment. And so they're looking for a way to condemn Jesus. Interestingly, they're following the Jewish law, which says you cannot condemn someone except out of the testimony of two or three witnesses, and those witnesses have to agree on each point. So they bring in a witness one at a time, and the witness would testify, then they'd bring in the next witness, and if that witness didn't completely agree with the first witness, independent testimony, then you couldn't bring the charge, you couldn't bring the judgment. And even though they're already set on where they want to go and what they want to accomplish, that they want to condemn Jesus, they're still holding to this letter of the law. They're still trying to feign a certain justice in the way in which they're going about it. And they can't get the witnesses to agree, and it's frustrating. It's like, what do we do? We got to condemn this guy. And so then the high priest stood up before them and asked Jesus, are you not going to answer? What is this testimony that these men are bringing against you? But Jesus remained silent and gave no answer. Jesus, like we said last week, is demonstrating just an incredible sovereignty. His prayer in the Garden of Gethsemane made him able to stand firm and strong and not have to utter a word. So again, the high priest asked him, are you the Messiah, the Son of the Blessed One? Jesus had, up to this point, steadfastly not stated outwardly and openly, I am the Messiah. But now is the time. And so he says, I am. And you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on the clouds of heaven. The high priest tore his clothes. Why do we need any more witnesses? He asked. You've heard the blasphemy. What do you think? And they all condemned him as worthy of death. Now, technically, what Jesus said was not blasphemy at all. Blasphemy is a word of curse against Yahweh, Jehovah, the God of Israel. And Jesus is simply making a claim. It's not a word of blasphemy at all. He's simply saying, I am the Messiah. And as you know and understand, the Messiah is the Son of the Blessed One. And he is going to come on clouds in glory. So it's not technically blasphemy, but for the high priest it was enough. Because he was already convinced that Jesus was not the Messiah. That Jesus was not the Son of the Blessed One. And that Jesus couldn't be. Because he challenged too many of their laws and challenged too many of their customs and didn't fit into the categories that they understood a Messiah was going to fit into. He couldn't be that. And so for Jesus to make that claim was a blasphemous claim, and all of the Sanhedrin agree. And then some of them began to spit at him, which would be fitting of someone they considered to be guilty of blasphemy. And they blindfolded him and struck him with their fists and said, "Prophesy." And the guards took him and beat him. It's interesting that they blindfolded Jesus and struck him with their fists and said, "Prophesy." That actually came out of an understanding of what the Jews expected from the Messiah. They thought that the Messiah would be able to. There was actually some witnesses, some literature that indicates that the teachers of the law thought that the Messiah would be able to identify people by a sense of smell. It was an interpretation that came out of a passage in Isaiah. Isaiah said this, "The Spirit of the Lord will rest on him," that is the Messiah, "the Spirit of wisdom and of understanding, a spirit of counsel and of might, the spirit of the knowledge and the fear of the Lord, and he will delight in the fear of the Lord." But this word delight is the same root as the word for smell, which you could kind of imagine, you know. How do we express delight? Well, we... last night when I, or two nights ago when I came into the house and there was the smell of the cake that Karen had, the bundt cake that Karen had baked, and it was like, delight. So there's the root is the same for delight as smell, and so it was translated, the idea was that He's going to smell through the fear of the Lord. He will not judge by what he sees with his eyes or decide by what he hears with his ears, but with righteousness he will judge the needy. And so there arose this idea that the Messiah would be able to judge through his sense of smell. In fact, there was actually a false Messiah. His name was Simon Bar Kokhba, and he was a messianic pretender, and he proclaimed rule for 2 years, and finally the Sanhedrin brought him in and tested him to see if he could judge through smell, and when he couldn't do it, they cut off his head. I don't know why I laughed at that, but... So that's what's going on here. They're blindfolding Jesus and saying, "Okay, we're going to test you, you know. Bam! Who hit you? Show us through your sense of smell." It was just a utter mockery that was going on. Now, at the same time that this trial is happening, there's another trial, parallel, that's happening at the same time, and it's happening in the courtyard. So while Peter was below in the courtyard, one of the servant girls of the high priest came by. And when she saw Peter warming himself, she looked closely at him. "You also were with that Nazarene, Jesus," she said. And she speaks it probably with a certain sense of disdain, "with that Nazarene." The Nazarenes were known as kind of the backwoods hicks of Israel. In fact, they even had an accent where they couldn't pronounce certain soft, the soft sound that is so important in the Semitic language. There were certain sounds that they couldn't quite pronounce right. It was an accent that they had, and they were known for that. And so, "Well, you were with him, that this Nazarene," but he denied it. "I don't know or understand what you're talking about," he said, and went out into the entryway. And when the servant girl saw him there, she said again to those standing around, "This fellow is one of them." And again he denied it. And after a little while, those standing near said to Peter, "Well, surely you are one of them, because you're a Galilean. We hear it in your speech." And he began to call down curses, and he swore to them, "I don't know this man you're talking about." And immediately the rooster crowed the second time. See, Jesus had said to Peter, "You think you're so tough? You think you're going to stand with me?" Actually, what's going to happen is before the cock crows twice, you're going to deny me three times. And the rooster crowed the second time, and then Peter remembered the words of Jesus, "Before the rooster crows twice, you will disown me three times." And he broke down and wept. Early rabbinic literature talks about the rooster crowing at three times in the night. One time about 12:30, and then he stops. And then an hour later about 1:30, and he stops. And then another hour later about 2:30, and he stops. So it could have been right about 1:30 in the morning.